This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Lead Time. I'm Vajra Kilgour.
I'm Eugene Hammond.
I'm Philip Kai.
Peace and justice.
And thank you, Community Bulletin Board crew. Remember, folks, WBAI is listener-sponsored. We are your community radio voice. And starting Monday, we'll be going into a fundraising drive. The economy, as you know, is taking a downturn, and we in the begging sector, who depends on the generosities of others, have taken quite a hit. So if you can help us here at the WBI, I'm asking to come on down to 120 Wall Street to volunteer some time and some energy in taking calls and taking the pledge of our generous listeners who can't afford to offer up some support to WBAI. The number to call is 212-209-2800. And Jennifer will take the necessary information and give you all the advice that you need and what you can do, the work that needs to be done at WBAI and the time frame in which it needs to be done. Thank you very much. As we all aware, the House have passed a $819 billion stimulus bill at the behest of President Barack Obama. The Republicans, to a last person, has boycotted and voted against that bill. Now it goes to the Senate for their consideration or their addition to that number. Well, how does that affect poor people here in the United States and throughout the world? Will this bill do anything to ameliorate the conditions under which they are living? Producer and colleague Dred Scott Keyes recently did a documentary called The End of Poverty. And we'll be bringing that to you over the next hour here at WBAI. So please, put this in your library and tell a friend to tune in and listen to this documentary produced by Dred Scott Keyes.
Talk about the rich and the super rich, the poor and the super poor. Come on, come on, come on, come on, yeah.
Talk about it, talk about it, talk about it, talk about it.
You say, you say, come on,
you tell them, come on,
you tell them.
Good evening and welcome to A People's History of the Poor. I'm Dred Scott Keyes. The current economic crisis confronting the world has led many to question the viability of the capitalist mode of production. But as any self-respecting economist will tell you, crisis in the capitalist world is nothing new, as it goes through cycles of booms and busts. However, capitalism as the current dominant world economic system faces issues heretofore unconfronted by the global community. Tonight we'll be looking into these issues through the eyes of the poor. From the barrios of Latin America to the slums of Africa, and from economists, experts, activists, and artists will explain how 20% of the world's population consumes more than 80% of the planet's resources, its consequences on Mother Earth and the world's people, especially the poor. An End to Poverty is a feature-length film produced by Cinema Libre Studios and the Robert Schockenbach Foundation, and was directed by Philip Diaz and narrated by actor Martin Sheen, and will be featured in this examination of the causes and cures of world poverty.
So much wealth, with modern cities and plentiful resources. How can we still have so much poverty, where so many people must live on less than $1 per day? Families live in one small room in squalid informal housing settlements, far away from skyscrapers and city centers, where they don't have the means to take care of themselves.
Hobbes's statement of the life being nasty, brutish, and short is a characterization of poverty.
Matya Sen, Nobel Prize winner in economics.
And there's no reason for us to take any different view than that. It's a question of understanding what it means in today's context, given the fact that there are means of enhancing wealth, means of curing illnesses and postponing death, means of making our lives comfortable. Given all that, if people still suffer from deprivation, well, then in the present context, we have to regard that as poverty.
The definition of poverty, it's true, is definitely the one, the official one, the $1 or $2 a day, is definitely not a right one.
Philip Diaz, director of An End to Poverty.
Because, you know, even if you have $5, you know, as you saw in the movie, there is a long scene with the sugarcane cutters in Brazil who earn between $7 and $8 a day, but they can still feed their family. Because there are so many tools to keep these people in poverty. You know, like, for example, they have to buy their food at the owner of the plantation store, you know, so of course, and which will charge them whatever he wants, you know, and they have to rent their equipment and pay for the equipment, etc. So everything is made for, at the end of the day, to make sure that they have nothing to take back home, so they have to continue working.
The men who would be known as the conquistadors and the colonizers came from Spain and Portugal, and later from the United Kingdom and Holland. They stole all the riches of the Incas and the Mayas, all the gold and silver, religious artifacts, and jewels, and then started to confiscate the land, which destroyed the natural economy of the people. Such a practice had long started before in Europe, where the upper classes seized communal land from the poor families, thus depriving them of their livelihood.
Part of the purpose of Europeans in the early age of exploration was to take Christianity to people around the world.
Writer and historian Clifford Cobb.
At the same time this was developing, a new form of Christianity was emerging that was very individualistic, and this was closely associated with an individualistic view of property. There had always been some element of private use, of individual families using property, but it was always tied to some communal affiliation. with the modern idea of private property, it meant that someone could use property without any obligation, any reciprocal relationship to community. You owned it, you could use it any way you wanted, and you didn't owe anyone anything. In a sense, this was a system of everyone for himself, and you could say this is the beginning of capitalism.
The conquistadors and the colonizers introduced the concept of superiority in terms of race and culture, in which the indigenous people were considered objects destined by God to slave for the white man. This created millions of marginalized people who still today have not recovered their place in society. During colonial times, no equality would be tolerated between the white man and the colored one, either in church or in state.
Again, Philip Diaz.
You know, we were in Bolivia, in Sucre, the former Bolivian capital, during Christmas time. And there was this wonderful mass in the cathedral of Sucre. And we went there, and what we saw is that even today, we saw that the old indigenous people will go to mass, but they will sit on the ground. They will not sit on the benches like everybody else, like all the mestizos, Spanish descendant. And that is fascinating to see at what point, you know, everything changed for them. And that's also something that we learn from all the experts, is that, you know, as Okoto Kendo was saying, like the worst that they brought was the concept of private property. The worst that they brought is also the change of culture and of mentality.
The Pope himself gave Africa to the Portuguese crown and South America to the Spanish.
Colonialism had very negative consequences, lasting consequences that we still see today in countries that are poor, and it's colonialism is one of the big reasons that poor countries are still poor.
Author and professor William Easterly.
It left a legacy of violence because it, the most obvious example of which is the slave trade, that millions of Africans were captured, kidnapped, and taken across the ocean under horrific conditions to be slaves for the colonial powers.
I think we have to start from what the prerequisites of capitalism are.
Author Michael Watts.
Capitalism cannot operate without free labor. Labor is a key cost of production. So, to the extent that what we're talking about here is an expansionary capitalism, it will always be looking for those circumstances.
As far as your eyes can see, men, women, and baby slaves come into the land of liberty, where life's design is already made. So young and so strong, they're just waiting to be saved. Oh, I'm so tired.
Land was confiscated and appropriated by the conquistadors and the colonizers throughout South America, Asia, and Africa, either by force or by imposing taxes on heads and huts that the people couldn't pay. Today, more than 500 years later, and dozens of years after the independence of their countries, people still don't have their lands back, which are still in the hands of large landowners and transnational corporations.
When the British came towards the end of the 19th century, their concern was to justify expropriation of land which did not belong to them.
H.W.O. Okoth Obendo, Kenyan author and law professor.
And the way they did it was to use their own legal system. They did this precisely through an advice that was given to the colonial government on the 13th of December 1897 that said that in countries where there is no settled form of government, the land belongs to the Queen of England. Having declared that there was no settled form of government, they appropriated ultimate title to the land. They passed laws that said so, and then they were able to give settlers freehold interest, 999-year leases, and other forms of leasehold.
The accumulation of resources in the Northern Hemisphere created this huge imbalance, making the North extremely wealthy, allowing Europe to develop its industries and to create consumer societies, while people living in the South became destitute, only able to watch their natural economy being destroyed and replaced by a commodity economy.
The preconditions for capitalism, the labor and market and strategic resources, are all about the process of primitive accumulation.
Again, Michael Watts.
You have to dispossess in differing ways to do all of those things. You can only get someone to work in a factory if they don't have access to land. That's a dispossession. Something can only become a market if it's taken out of a non-market context. Something has to be bought and sold. It can only be a strategic resource precisely if, in fact, you exploit that resource. Primitive accumulation is not something that happens once. It happened in this way under specific circumstances in Brazil in the 16th century. But primitive accumulation is recursive. It happens time and time again under different sorts of conditions. Of course, there's an enormous amount of hype about this. But the reality is, of course, we're no less dependent on key strategic resources now than we were in 1890. And it's not just about oil, it's about a whole raft of key minerals and resources that are absolutely indispensable.
The resources of the South are fundamental to development in the North. And therefore, the manner in which access and control of those resources are determined becomes crucial for the North. That is where the battle has always been. It has been there for over a century. It continues to be there. And particularly when it comes to subterranean resources. I mean, just look around you. Why did the Angolan War take that long? Or the Congo? Why aren't we interested in what's going on in Somalia? Because there is nothing to expropriate there. But there's something to expropriate in Sudan, in the Congo, in Angola, and in various places.
To maintain this level of wealth extraction, the conquerors needed to keep their colonies in a state of dependency. They assigned a function to each country or region as the producer of certain minerals or a certain crop, like tea, coffee, cocoa, or sugarcane, that could be exported back to the mother country. This imposed monoculture plunged these countries into a locked economy and into a state of total dependency. The survival of their people now depended on the goodwill of the motherland from which they had to import food. The consequences of that practice can still be seen 500 years later.
One of the legacies of colonialism is that the poor countries of the Third World are continuing to export raw materials, and the countries of Europe and North America produce and export finished products.
Clifford Cobb, writer and historian.
This stems from a practice that was developed long ago, and the intention was to make sure that the countries of the Third World remain backward and remain dependent and are never able to develop. So to this day, they are continuing to survive on the export of raw materials. That has always been to the disadvantage of the country exporting the raw materials, and it gets worse each year.
The main legacy of the colonizers was the change in mentality, religion, and culture. They came with a Bible in one hand and a rifle in the other, preaching the exclusivity of salvation and imposing Christianity by force upon all, destroying every indigenous religious item they could find. Having obtained natural resources and free labor, the Europeans now needed to create new markets for their own productions. They separated agriculture from industry, thus preventing the farmers from making their own tools, clothes, and other utensils, and transforming them into commodity buyers. All existing industries were destroyed, and the colonies were forced to buy manufactured goods and equipment from their colonial masters.
Again, Philip Diaz.
You know, it's very interesting to look at the whole picture and say, if there was something happening in the world which would prevent the North from stealing the resources in Africa, in South America, or in Asia, you know, and not use this very cheap workforce or this free workforce, all this empire would collapse in 5 minutes. Europe, Japan, you know, United States. There is no way that we can maintain this kind of economy without stealing the resources in all these continents.
This sort of world order that the West and basically the United States and to some extent Western Europe have tried to maintain.
David Elliman is former economic advisor to the World Bank.
It's very post-colonial in the sense that we don't try to directly politically control these countries, but we want to integrate them into an international economic order and to some extent political order. And so even the very definitions of development, the very definitions of local industry and so forth, it's all geared in a very natural way to the needs of the North and extracting resources, extracting cheap labor, not creating genuine foreign competition. So if you're going to have cars produced in Africa, we'll come do it for you there and we'll use your workers and so forth. And so in that sense, it's very much a subtle form of an empire, but not an old-style empire.
Some of the settlers, when they moved from this country in 1964-65 up to 1970, now they benchmarked their operations in Europe, and therefore we became the producers of raw materials, and they were now the agents for marketing and processing.
Kaprito Arap Kirwa, Kenyan agricultural minister.
Therefore, all the value addition of our crops were done away from Africa. Because roasting of coffee, just to pick that particular crop, is done away from Kenya. In fact, you are aware that Germany, which does not have a single bush of coffee, is the largest exporter of coffee. Tea is the same. The tea that you consume in Sudan, you take it first to Europe. Then Lipton brings it back to Sudan and a number of other countries in Northern Africa and a number of other countries.
Our government needs to stop thinking of Brazil as a colony.
Maria Luisa Mendoca, Rede Social President of Brazil.
The policies we have right now are the same as we had in the period of colonization. You know, over and over in history, what was the function in Brazil in the international economy was to produce cheap goods for the North. Before, at the beginning, was sugar. Now we are back to the sugar cane production. Then it was coffee. Then it was gold. You know, we are always producing cheap, basic materials for the North.
When the countries of the South won their independence, the accumulated debts of the colonial powers used to open new markets were transferred to the newly formed governments in total violation of international laws. The only solution offered by the North was more debt with extremely high interest in order to repay the initial one. these newly formed states immediately lost their sovereignty and became even more dependent upon the northern countries, which could then dictate policies on agriculture, trade, and customs, and give special privileges to foreign corporations, such as monopolies over mineral extraction or monoculture exploitation.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference.
The key institution set up was the International Monetary Fund. And the purpose of the fund was to have a bank they could turn to for short-term borrowing to serve the short-term trading interests of the winners of the war.
United States Treasury Secretary Morgenthau heads the American delegation. To be discussed are plans for the stabilization of world currencies.
Same time, they set up the World Bank to provide capital for the rebuilding of Europe. You have to remember, what we now know as the Third World didn't exist. There were a few major powers, each of which had a large empire. We had no voice, we had no presence, we just were part of somebody else's power structure. You ask whose interest? Ask the question, who set it up?
Them and them economical plan still can't find a solution. Borrowing money for lend. World Bank and our friend. Is life and death all are we afraid? Life and death, freedom not yet.
That was former Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley explaining the origins of the International Monetary Fund, and is featured in the just-completed full-length documentary, Life and Debt, which addresses the impact of the IMF, World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the current globalization policies on developing countries focusing on Jamaica.
When we wished for independence from Great Britain, we had something else in mind. We cannot now remember what that was. So you could imagine how I felt when one day driving on the Queen's Highway I asked myself, is the Jamaica that I see before me, self-ruled, a worse off place than it was when dominated by the bad-minded English?
With a voiceover narration adapted from Jamaica Kincaid's book, A Small Place, Life and Debt is an unapologetic look at the New World Order. The film dissects the mechanism of debt that is destroying local agriculture and industry in so-called third world countries, while substituting sweatshops and cheap imports. The film's producer and director is Stephanie Black. She explains how the IMF works and why she did the film.
You're confronted immediately with the poverty of the country, and at the same time, you're confronted immediately to the absolute beauty and wealth of the country. And the film was really prompted by a very simple question is, how is a country with this much resources, this rich, this poor? And that started the inquiry. And what happens is the IMF comes and visits the country and will meet with the leaders, meet with the Minister of Finance. They will purport what they want to do. And then the IMF will tell them what they need to do. And then the interesting mechanism of it is that the country itself, the Minister of Finance, has to draw up a letter to the IMF asking them for the money to do what the IMF said that they should do. And then that becomes the agreement. Privatization of national industry has to be put in place. Devaluation of currency has to be put in place. Reduction of the public sector employees has to be put in place. And there are benchmark conditionalities. As they achieve the specifications that the IMF sets, then they get the next payment.
Welcome to Jamaica. What's good is what you.
After 400 years of colonization, Jamaica gained its independence in 1962. It attempted to build its economy on self-sufficiency and independence, but due to a variety of external and internal pressures, it was unable to do so without foreign loans. Michael Manley was elected Prime Minister in 1976 on a non-IMF, non-aligned platform. Black says he was forced to sign Jamaica's first loan agreement with the IMF in 1977 due to a lack of viable alternatives.
He actually had very interesting ideas. He went to the Arab oil-producing countries to see if maybe they would invest some of their profits in developing countries as opposed to putting them in banks in England, but that didn't work out. He went to the Soviet Union to see if they can lend Jamaica money, and that didn't work out. And as a kind of last resort, he went to the IMF because countries cannot get loans from commercial banks unless they get the seal of approval from the IMF. So once the IMF is lending to the country, then you can get money from Citibank and Barclays and such as well. But until that point happens, you can't.
Manley's dilemma is the same dilemma faced by many leaders of newly independent countries. Again, Stephanie Black.
Every single leader, all the leaders in the film actually, Aristide was elected on a non-IMF platform. Rawlings was elected on a non-IMF platform. So actually the leaders who have been the most verbal and the most outspoken in the end have been the leaders who have had to sign their countries into IMF programs because in the global economy there really is no other option.
Persistent complaints about work conditions at the Kingston Free Zone led our news team this morning to investigate complaints against one factory there.
The fine line workers stopped working on Monday, accusing the government of being co-conspirators in the exploitation of free zone labor by foreign companies. They say the problem
during the 1980s, the U.S. set up free trade zones with Jamaica and other countries, which offered incentives to foreign garment companies.
No government. We don't have any government. We don't have nobody to stand for.
Fine Line is owned by a larger company, Schweitzer and Associates, based in Alexandria, Virginia, USA.
They were promised that the workers would not be unionized. They would not allow unions to come in.
You can't talk to nobody. You can't eat. You can't get up to go bathroom. They're watching you. Miserable. It's like you're working under slavery.
Because people get fired and them not taking on anybody to work in the next year.
And then they bring in the Chinese to back it up, to back up the Jamaicans, and they treat the Chinese better than us.
There are even more problems in the island's garment sector this evening, with production at one factory all but stalled.
If the government asked them to give us more, probably they would close down the factories and go to Mexico, because most of them gone to Mexico, because they say they are cheaper labor.
You know, these companies are very aggressive to make profits, and they're accountable to their shareholders. So they basically just went, you know, they're in a position to move the production to areas that are, you know, cheaper for them.
I worked there for 15 years, and they fired me for low production. See, I'm not doing enough. They want me to do 1,000, and I couldn't go up to it.
The free trade and NAFTA agreements have impacted initially very badly on Jamaica.
We've lost, I think, 18,000 jobs.
It's getting worse. More factory closing down.
Low-wage jobs do move or gravitate to low-wage areas. This is happening throughout the world, especially with the new order.
The garment factory on Marcus Garvey Drive has thrown over 400 workers into a tailspin.
2 weeks ago, the workers received a letter which stated that the factory would be closing temporarily for restructuring. Allegations flew that the Asian managers had dismantled and sold the factory equipment and packed their bags in preparation for a hasty departure. The factory will not reopen tomorrow, and the majority of workers have not been paid.
The government built factories with loans from international agencies like the IMF and the World Bank. They still came out the loans.
The government is now paying us 52 cents out of every dollar that it collects in interest payments on debt. That leaves 48 cents to do everything else.
The interesting thing is that even though the loans are being paid back now, at a high interest rate, really, because of the exchange rate, more factories are closing and more people are out of jobs. So I don't see the purpose. The real purpose has not been met.
Let me say free zone is for the poor, but I don't see it.
I better them close down the zone, make we organize something for ourselves and sell the product out here. I feel like it would be much better.
Over 500 workers have been added to the unemployment line as Haines Jamaica Limited ended today the weeks of speculation and officially announced that yes, it was closing its Hanover plant.
You taste a delicious Jamaican-grown banana for the very first time. You wonder how it is that you've never tasted such a sweet banana before.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
The Jamaican banana industry was granted preferential treatment from the British through the Lomé Convention, which provided a tax-free import quota of more than 100,000 tons of fruit to England. Oddly, the U.S. government, on behalf of the Chiquita and Dole multinational corporations, is demanding that the Lomé Convention quota be removed. Again, Stephanie Black.
What was brought to the WTO was the fight to eliminate this Lomé agreement. To call it was unconstitutional in this kind of new world order because Chiquita and Dole, which already control 95% of the world's banana production, feel it's unfair that they have to pay a tariff while the ACP countries don't.
The Americans, and to be brutally frank, I think it's Mr. Linda and his millionaires at Chiquita, are pressuring the ex-colonial countries through the WTO.
Aside from driving down wages, the free trade zones and the IMF economic policies are one-way streets, as in the case of McDonald's and other fast food restaurants operating in Jamaica. Stephanie Black.
The problem with McDonald's in Jamaica is that they don't use any of the local products there. There's beef growers who would love to be able to supply McDonald's.
McDonald's have asked us to supply them with a hot dog plan. We have done that. We have made burgers for them, which they have sampled and found to be okay. In fact, the taste has been much better than the ones they had imported, but we still have not been able to supply them.
While certain businesses thrive in Jamaica, the increase in poverty has had dire social consequences.
And what happens is there's an increased violence in the country because if people are out of work, and the hope for the future is not very promising.
Tonight there are violent protests over higher taxes and fuel prices in Jamaica.
As many as six people have been reported killed in the unrest that is sweeping across that Caribbean island.
It escalated in the past 24 hours, an 18-year-old dead at this home. The jump in the gas tax is hard in a country with many poor. The government defends it as a way to pay for bank failures, but now suggests there may be room for compromise.
The interesting experience in making the film was the incredible awareness and clarity of how these policies impact on the day-to-day life.
They're telling you that, look, if we lend you $50 million. In return, you have to lower all your trade barriers and you have to compete with us on a level playing field. Well, that is all double talk.
In the free zone, where we term the slave zones, you find that the average worker is working far less than what that company would have paid a worker in America.
We do our rule under our government, but the government not seeing the things to help the people, or to do the things to help the people. What they are doing between the American government and the Jamaican government is to still join hands and hand to oppress the poorer class of people more than more.
But what really beat our government still is just the money where them want, you know, and doing busy with the term. That really go with the money.
The terms and conditions.
And conditions that go with the money. It's on to the money. You see, we are so poor that these rich people use their money to really just push their money before, like it's a gift. But it's really a trap.
Them and them economical plan still can't find a solution. Borrowing money for them. World Bank and our friend. Life and death, all are we afraid. Life and death, freedom not yet. Farmers get a blow, foreign food so and so. American farmers get a upper hand. While our farmers going one by one. Bankrupt, PSLash, newsflash. Big boy, item stash. No money, no job. Borrowing money, filling. Capitalism and our friend.
C.
sub-Saharan Africa, which is the poorest part of the world, is paying $25,000 every minute to northern creditors.
Susan George is chair of the French-based Transnational Institute.
You could build a lot of schools, a lot of hospitals, a lot of job, you could make a lot of job creation if you were using $25,000 a minute differently from debt repayment. So there's this drain, and I think people don't understand that it is actually the South that is financing the North. If you look at the flows of money from North to South and then from South to North, what you find is that the South is financing the North to the tune of about $200 billion every year.
The IMF and the World Bank, by liberalizing capital flows, opened up a wholly new criminal environment where capital could be shifted into tax havens around the world and evade tax. And this has happened on a truly astonishing scale.
John Christensen, director of the British-based Tax Justice Network.
To give an idea of the size of this movement, the most recent estimate of the volume of capital now held offshore by rich individuals is $11.5 trillion. And a stunningly large figure. And for those people who want to tackle poverty, this raises intriguing questions, because if we were able to tax that capital at even a very modest rate, at 30% on the income, we would be able to raise at least $255 billion a year of extra tax revenue around the world, which could be used for all sorts of brilliant purposes, but it would more than pay for the Millennium Development Goal program of tackling poverty.
We are afraid is life and death. Freedom not yet. Life and death. All are we afraid. Life and death. Freedom not yet. Life and death. All are we afraid. Life and death. Freedom not yet. Them and them economical plan. See, can't find a solution. Borrowing money for lend. World Bank and now a friend.
Neoliberalism managed to bankrupt many of the economies of the South, which allowed international capital to take over. This was achieved by imposing a new form of structural violence that was used for decades to maintain these countries in a state of underdevelopment. Such violence was implemented by the dictators of the South and their repressive apparatus, which finally brought social unrest that was unkind to the free market economies.
The Washington Consensus had four key strands. First of all, capital account liberalization. Secondly, trade liberalization. Thirdly, reduce your taxes, stimulate growth, follow the Laffer curve. A bit like following the yellow brick road. It led nowhere at all. But tax revenues went south for most developing countries, particularly in Africa. The fourth strand of the Washington Consensus was sell off your state's assets. And in most cases, they were sold off so badly, and the fees that were paid to World Bank consultants and all of the Western consultants involved were so astronomical that the end price that many developing countries got for their sales were minimal.
The special agents and economic hitmen were born and became the new, less visible means to maintain such control over the globe's resources.
Like what a democratically elected leader of another country is doing, for example, opposing the exploitation of oil in his country, someone who looks like me will walk into that president's office. I had the job at one time.
John Perkins is author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Walks into the office and says, and now I just want to remind you that I can make you and your family very, very rich if you play my game, our game. Or I can see to it that you're thrown out of office or assassinated if you decide to fulfill your campaign promises. And usually it's said a little more subtly than that because there may be a tape recorder listening. But they get the message because every one of those presidents knows what happened to Arbenz of Guatemala and Allende of Chile and Roldos of Ecuador and Lumumba of the Congo and Torrijos and on. The list is very long of presidents that we have had thrown out or assassinated. There's no question about that. And they all know this. So we perpetuate the system that way. Here you offer from this pocket you offer a few hundred million dollars, corruption. Or from this pocket you offer subversives, jackals, to go in and overthrow the government or assassinate the president. And this has happened time and time and time again. Usually the economic hitmen are successful, so we don't need to send in the jackals. But on those occasions when we're not successful, as for me, I failed with Omar Torrijos in Panama and Jaime Roldos in Ecuador. And so the jackals were sent in and assassinated these men.
Chalmers Johnson, former CIA analyst.
There is no question that over the years, the government has used its imperial apparatus for economic purposes, for the advantage of American firms. Perhaps the best examples are the United Fruit Company in Central America, and that is after the overthrow of the government of Guatemala in 1954 by brutal, very brutal means against a small and defenseless country. Over the years, leading to civil war, police repression, at least 200,000 Guatemalan civilians have lost their lives. All this was done because the United Fruit Company objected to some rather modest proposals for land reform. You could carry it on to the CIA's intervention against Allende in order to bring to power probably the most odious military dictator in the Cold War period, General Pinochet. Here the interests were primarily of AT&T company. They participated closely, the International Telephone and Telegraph, participated closely with the CIA in financing and funding and plotting the coup against Salvador Allende. Also equally in Chile, the mining interests of the big copper firms, one of the things that American imperial power has long been used in Latin America in order to protect the interest of extractive industries in very poor countries such as Bolivia, places of that sort.
Again, John Perkins.
We will identify a country, usually a developing country, that has resources we covet, our corporations covet, like oil. And then we arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. Now, most everybody in our country believes that that loan is going to help poor people. It isn't. Most of the money never goes to the country. In fact, it goes to our own corporations. It goes to the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and the ones we all hear about, usually led by engineering firms, but a lot of other companies are brought in. And they make fortunes off building big infrastructure projects in that country. Power plants, industrial parks, ports, those types of things. The country's left holding this huge debt that it can't possibly repay. So at some point, we economic hitmen go back in and we say, you know, you can't pay your debts. You owe us a pound of flesh.
Again, Susan George.
All of the public companies, whether they had to do with investing in agriculture or whether they were public telephone companies or public whatever, roads companies or all of that, or nearly all, has had to be privatized. So there again, you get an opportunity for private companies to extract wealth. The World Bank used to publish, maybe it still does, but all through the 80s and the early 90s, every year it published in microscopic print long lists of companies that had been privatized in its member countries under structural adjustment programs. And every year, I counted them approximately, it was sort of 1,300 to 1,500 companies a year. They were sometimes bought by local elites. They were often, particularly the larger ones, bought by our own transnational corporations.
Jim Schultz, president of the Democracy Center of Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Bolivia became the lab rat. Bolivia was absolutely the chief test lab in South America for these policies of privatization, market fundamentalism, the things that led to the water revolt, that led to all of these issues here in Bolivia. And that's really the trajectory of how Bolivia got here historically.
Marcela Oliveira, water defense coordinator of Bolivia.
It was like the last thing to privatize here because the governments before already privatized everything, you know, railroads, airlines, telecommunications. So, like, water was the last frontier to cross. Some parts of the law said that all the water sources suddenly will not belong to the communities or to the people or neighborhoods. They will belong to the water company now. Suddenly, these things that were common were not common anymore.
They came here, and within a month of taking over, they raised people's water rates by an average of 50%, and in some cases, double and more. People took to the streets and said they wouldn't take it, and faced down bullets, faced down a state of martial law.
The health system, where people used to get drugs free of charge, now they have to go and pay.
Eric Njindi, community coordinator of Action Aid in Kenya.
Where I come from myself, I see people who are not able to go to hospital. They die of simple things like malaria because they cannot afford to pay the small fee that is required to run the hospitals. This used to be run by the government, but the World Bank insisted that the wage bill is too high and that the government has to reduce its expenditure. And reducing expenditure meant ignoring majority of the people. And that's what happened, that many people in Kenya do not have access to health facilities and do not have access to education.
We are three children. I'm Joseph. This is my sister, she's Helen, but she's disabled, and my other brother, he's called Josephat Odongo, and he's also disabled. So among the three of us, I'm the only person who at least can do something. I'm not at school because I'm supposed to pay 4,000 for the exam fees and 10,000 for the school fees, and my mom is earning 3,000, so I'm still at home, I cannot get the money. Okay, I can say life in the slum is very hard. Okay, sometimes we do go without even eating supper now. The small that we have, we do share among ourselves. Some people are eating 3 meals per day, and for you, you can just have 1 meal a day. And also when you go to school, you know, we have different types of people. And also there's some discrimination there because you know, you're not of the same class with the other students. I do feel discriminated because you can find, like, the things which they have in compared to what you have. They'll just laugh at you because you're just a slum dweller. Let's say when someone is sick, even going to the hospital, it's very hard than to buy the medicine. So maybe he'll just stay at home and take some tablets from the shop for around 10 shillings. And you cannot afford to go to the hospital.
There is a great irony today that the developed countries of the world are talking about free trade as if that's the solution to the problem of poverty in the world.
Clifford Cobb, writer and historian.
Much of the history of the last couple of centuries has been an effort of countries to become economically independent through tariffs to be able to develop manufactured goods. The economies of Asia most recently developed in large part because of the ability to, or East Asia, I should say, developed in large part because they developed behind tariffs. And then once they developed to a point where they were able to enter the world economy on the same footing as everyone else, then they removed the tariffs. Now, because the United States and European powers have prevented third world countries from doing that, and in fact are imposing tariffs to prevent the import of the finished goods from third world countries, and in fact are not practicing free trade, it's all a way of keeping the third world countries in their place and preventing them from ever developing.
John Stiglitz is a former advisor to the World Bank.
In some countries, rapid liberalization of trade has meant that corn farmers have to compete with heavily subsidized corn. Their income goes down up to 50% as a result of that competition. Sugar, each of the commodities we can talk about, the liberalization of the market, opening the markets to highly subsidized agriculture, drives down the price and forces these farmers out of business, or if they stay in business, leads them to have much lower income. Another example is intellectual property. The intellectual property regime has made access to life-saving drugs much more difficult for the poor countries. It was essentially signing a death warrant on thousands of people.
These people you see over here, they are pastoralists and agriculturalists. It is livestock farming that they depend on. They cultivate maize. Now all those is gone. Now, come the year 2003, they told us that government is coming to invest here. Instead of seeing government, we saw a very unique company. This is a company from USA. Edmond, Oklahoma, USA. The company is called Dominion Group of Companies. This company is investing here, is in collaboration with Kenya government to invest here. This company is doing aerial spraying. Now, the aeroplane makes a U-turn right across our homes. And this aerial spraying is done when, especially when people are working. It is done twice a week. That has a affected us very much. And when you go to nearby public health centers, quite a number of children has been reported dead. And it's quite unfortunate that what he produces there, the little that he produces there, are not sold to us. They are ferried to America. They are taken back to America. So we, the local people, the land is ours. We gain nothing from that land. It is the American government gaining, and maybe some corrupt government officials. So we are now subjected to a life of servitude in our own ancestral land. And we don't feel like moving away from that land. This is our ancestral land, and whatsoever we won't move out of this land.
For decades, poverty reduction and development programs have failed to confront the different forms of power and the structural violence that hold more than two-thirds of the world in dire straits. Our chosen economic model has created a global situation in which today, less than 25% of the world's population uses more than 80% of the planet's resources, while creating 70% of its pollution.
unless we change radically the system, we will continue to dig the hole.
Philip Diaz, director of An End to Poverty.
Because again, if we are consuming 30% more than what the planet regenerates, it means we dig the hole every year a little bit more. It's in terms of pollution, it's in terms of, you know, even consumption.
Just living.
You know, so exactly. So we have to change radically the system. And the thing is that unless we build a very strong movement in America to force Barack Obama to not become another Clinton government, because, you know, we should always remember that the people that he's surrounding himself with right now are the people who were the architects of deregulation
right.
in the United States under Clinton. And that's what created this major mess that we are in. You know, and it's like, you know, and the Bolivian example is the answer, I think. The change has to come from the bottom. Unless we create a very strong social movement, a very strong grassroots movement, we will push all these leaders, and it's not just Barack Obama, it's everybody in the world, to change the system. We will not make it. You know, we are going to the disaster and to the end of the planet, clearly.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.